Hey, are you here?
Yes, good morning, Chair. I'm here.
Okay, good morning. No problem.
Afternoon.
Hayi, akukhonjani. Sekusasa nje siyaqala ukubonana.
Good afternoon, Chair and honorable members.
Afternoon, Mr. Ngwepe.
Afternoon, Ngwepe.
Afternoon, Mr. Ngwepe.
Okay.
Honorable members and colleagues, it's 4 o'clock. I think we may start. I still can notice that the chair is still on a sick leave and disposed. Then we will proceed with the meeting. The meeting is officially open, colleagues and honorable members. And all of us are most welcome, and thank you very much for availing yourselves to this meeting. We are all welcome. With that, without any delays, I will go quickly to the apologies. What we have received as apologies from our side through Masipala's office is that Honorable Malumane has apologized. We recall that she was emotionally and she was not quite fit to resume her duties, but now and then she does attend the meetings. And also an apology from Honorable Deputy Minister Chikunga, whom she's going to join the meeting slightly late. However, she has a cabinet meeting that she needs to leave for as well. In terms of the minister, I've noticed on the system here that we've got. I will recognize you, Dr. Gondre. I'll come back to you. The DG, Ms. McCarthy, probably, or Caroline will advise us about the minister because the DM hasn't yet joined the meeting before I hand over to the DG. But let me take first. Honorable Gondwe, over to you, ma'am, and the apologies.
Yes, thank you very much, Honorable Lusoma. I would like to tender an apology on behalf of Honorable Schreiber.
Okay, apology, as I'm sure with all the apologies. Any other apology before I close the window for apologies? It doesn't look like. With that, Ms. McCarthy, any apology from the minister or Caroline might know? I'm not too sure. You'll tell us so that we can record it properly. Or you'll be joining us slightly late as well. Okay. No, thank you very much, DG. If you can just sort out your line, it's like you are in an aeroplane and you are trying to talk on in the aeroplane. We can hardly hear you, but we have captured some few words that you are saying that the minister is also held up in the same meeting that the DM is in. They will then, if it happens that we'll still be on, they will join us. Thank you very much for that. Honorable members, Honorable Gondwe, your hand is still up or is a permanent hand up?
My apologies, Honorable Lusoma, it's an old one. Let me put it down.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay. So may I take that all the apologies presented are accepted by the committee? And noted those ones that need to be noted. With that, silence is golden. Thank you very much. All apologies accepted by the committee. That will bring us, honorable members, to item of the day, which is point three. But also I must say that you will recall that we agreed and we applied to have a meeting during recess. However, due to the non-availability of the minister on the scheduled day, which was the 24th of last month, so and then he indicated his availability today. Notwithstanding that, we would not necessarily want to be seen also competing with the cabinet, but we said if then DG or any person or official mandated by his office from his good self, that may come and address the committee. So the item before us is a progress, implementation progress on single public service, as it were. Among that, which the DG will talk to more of an opening and also then zoom in terms of the actual matter, is that you will recall, members, that sometime last year, just after June, the minister did talk to this matter when we're raising the issue of, I think it was linked on some other issues in terms of the public service wage bill, but also other related matters. And it was felt that, and also in our last, it's a true last meeting, if I'm not mistaken, where Honorable Stryper also, when the minister was talking to the subject matter, but also he had he seeked a permission also to give the minister the members, I'll term it inverted commas, because now it was asserted by the committee and referred to the minister, which in one way or indirectly also tend to talk to the single public service, as it were. So here we are, honorable members and colleagues. Then the department is ready as one of their stakeholder engagement, as it were, but not only dealing or focusing on the amendment bill that is before the cabinet and the department, but as one of the stakeholders, but also the main purpose is to take us through the progress status towards the single public service, as it were. There are a number of reasons that the DG will talk to that needs to be addressed, but you'll recall also one of the targets of this sixth administration was to review the public service administration in terms of its structure, as it were, which then I want to believe the single public service, one of those activities is to review the public service structure, as it were, for all departments, so that we cut costs, but also we place people where they are supposed to be placed, and also where there's a proper secondment and related matters, it does comply with the legal transcript, as it were. So, honorable members, allow me then to ask the DG to take us through the subject matter. Over to you, DG. Thank you very much and your team for attending as well. Your network, DG, is terrible. Try it again. No, it's not improving. Do you have plan B for somebody to take over? Why are you supposed to put your line? DG, can you just ask one of your colleagues to take over, because definitely we can hardly hear you. And I'm sure the members will agree with me. Honorable members, can you hear the DG?
No, you can't, Chair.
Yes, we've got a difficulty, DG. Can you get somebody else to help? Meanwhile, you are sorting your way, probably it's where you are located now.
Good afternoon, Chair. It's Renisha
Naidoo. Thank you, Renisha. Over to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. DG is just trying to sort her connection out, but I will do the presentation while she catches up. Chair, if you recall, last year we came to the portfolio committee and we presented on what we were projecting as policy changes and the type of changes we were predicting would then go into a bill. We have since then we have drafted the bills. We have consulted the bills with cabinet. and we are here to present the draft bills. We have also published these bills for public comment. It was published in the Government Gazette of the 6th of April, and it was published for 30 days. So we are still receiving and will receive public comments through that process. The minister is also engaging with other stakeholders in respect of the content of the bill. As part of those consultation processes, we are also consulting with the portfolio committee to bring to the notice of the portfolio committee what the draft bill looks like. It will be subject to change as we go through the process. So, so this is just the outline as the bills are currently. The presentation is in the format of an introduction, taking from what we've previously presented to the portfolio committee and where we are now. We've also focused on the Public Administration Management Amendment Bill, which is the Single Public Administration Initiative. We will present the context of the legislation as well as the amendment, and we will do the similar process for the Public Service Amendment Bill. So we have two bills that we intend to table before Parliament in this financial year. That is our goal. Madam Chair and to the committee members, we have refocused our energy to look at the four pillars of public administration. And we have focused our bills to make sure that our bills meet these four pillars that the public administration hinges on. The first pillar is the citizens. How do the citizens benefit from the public administration? So everything we do in these bills must have some sort of benefit to the citizens. How does government use these bills to deliver on its mandate and its obligations to the citizens of South Africa? What is expected from the public service itself, the service that the service must render, or the public service must render? How will we do that to meet the demands of the citizens as well as government's obligations? And lastly, we focus on, but not in any particular order, we focus on the employees themselves. What exactly is expected from public servants to ensure that the system of public service is properly rendered? We focus on these four elements because they are interdependent. If one fails, then the system's not sustainable. If we move to the next slide, we have therefore considered these pillars holistically, and we have tried to create a public administration that is people-centered, that is cohesive, that is synergized, that is efficient and effective. We are attempting to find professionalization of public administration to ensure that the values and principles of Section 195 are realized. We are also looking at the state's capacity, that is its employees that have the necessary skills and attributes, as well as the state's capability, which is about the systems, the structures, and the processes that will deliver services to the citizens of the country. So that is our key focus as we move through the reforms that we are looking at. And the next slide, please. Madam Chair, the first bill we are contemplating is the Public Administration Management Amendment Bill. On the next slide, please. We have basically premised these amendments on the Single Public Administration Initiative, which we know started in around 2002. The idea was to have a single public administration governed by a single bill or a single act, which would form the central basis that was PAMA. We had initially sought to replace the existing legislation, which is the Single Public Service Act as well as the Municipal Systems Act. But as we have gone through PAMA, we have realized that PAMA does not repeal or replace the other pieces of legislation, and we don't propose that we do that. What we are proposing is that we manage the public administration through the three pieces of legislation. And we leverage on existing legislation. So our primary focus for the amendment is to ensure that we identify gaps within existing legislation and we deal with those gaps, so we provide for those gaps. We also use the existing legislation to align our norms and standards across the public administration. So that would require coordination between the various departments, the various stakeholders. And we still aspire towards the realization of a single public administration. So the areas that we have identified for PAMA that are gaps and which we need to correct or introduce new measures is a measure to remove unjustifiable disparities across government. We recognize that the different spheres of government are distinct. They are interdependent and interrelated. We want to create a mechanism which will allow that when remuneration and conditions of service are determined throughout the public service, there are mechanisms that manage those processes at a central point so that the one arm of government knows what the other arm of government is doing. So we coordinate better. I will speak specifically to those provisions as we get to them. On the next slide, please. The first area of amendment for the PAMA is Clause 1. We have identified definitions that require further elaboration or new definitions that need to be introduced, and we have done that. The definitions are important as we go through the context, but some of the definitions to note is that we've introduced head of institution, which was mentioned in the primary act but not defined. We also introduced the Labor Relations Act, the public administration, we redefine it slightly to include SOEs for certain provisions, and public entities we define for purposes of Section 8. In terms of individual transfers, this has recently raised eyebrows since we have published the bill, and I think it needs special attention by the committee. And for that reason, I'll spend a little bit of time to explain why we are proposing what we are proposing so that it's clearer as we move through the process. Currently, Section 14 of the Public Service Act provides for the transfers of employees between national government and provincial government. It allows for the employer to initiate transfers and to transfer employees between those two spheres of government, even if the employee does not consent. So it's not a new provision. It's something that is currently in Section 14 of the Public Service Act. What we are introducing into PAMA, because PAMA as it currently stands is a section that deals with the transfers of employees. It currently provides that if you want to transfer an employee across the spheres of government, including to municipalities, you would need the permission and the consent of the employee. When PAMA comes into operation, or Section 5 of PAMA comes into operation, PAMA also repeals Section 14. PAMA does not currently provide for employer-initiated transfers. So if and when PAMA is brought into operation and Section 14 of the Public Service Act is repealed, there will be a lacuna that will be created. So we will have a gap in the legislation where the employer would not be able to initiate transfers. So the amendment that we are proposing in this amendment bill is to deal with that particular gap that will be created. So we are proposing that there should be a provision that allows the employer to transfer employees, even though the employee may not consent. But we don't do that in a reckless manner. The proposal is that we do it after we have consulted with the employee and after and only if it's due to operational reasons. So we've put two provisos, and those are parts of the amendment. But the other parts of PAMA, which are already in the Act itself, require that when you transfer an employee, with or without their consent, there must be reasonable grounds. So apart from operational justification, there must be reasonable grounds. The second provision, which is already in PAMA, it's already a requirement under the law, is that when you transfer an employee to a particular position, that employee must be suitably qualified. And that definition of what is suitably qualified comes from the Employment Equity Act. That employee must be suitably qualified to perform the functions to which he or she is transferred. So we don't intend to change anything. That is still a requirement, and it's a requirement under the PAMA. The third requirement is that when an employee is transferred, whether employer-initiated or employee-initiated, that employee must not suffer any detriment to his or her salary. So there must be no reduction in benefits. So the principles of transfer have taken into account all employee rights and all employer obligations. The reason behind requiring or creating legislation that gives the employer the ability to transfer an employee without consent is only where operational circumstances justify. And operational circumstances usually arise where functions are transferred, departments are restructured, where government priorities and resources change, where there is a need to change the way a department is structured, the way governments are structured, then it becomes an inherent part of that process that people have to move. You have to be able to move resources to where they are located. That is one element of where such a transfer will take place. The other element would be where resources are deficient in a particular department, in a particular municipality, and you want to give the employer the ability to deploy skills where it has the skills where the skills are needed. So those would be the operational requirements, provisions that we seek to address through this amendment. We have been very cautious as we have gone through this amendment to make sure that these processes do not impede the rights of employees. They do not lend itself to abuse by the employer. And to make sure that whatever risk is inherent in this process, the need for this provision must outweigh the risk. So what we are saying to the committee is that this amendment is necessary. We have put in place all of the checks and balances to make sure that employees are not victimized or abused through these processes. And we are proposing, therefore, that the insertion, and it's only one part of the provision, that an insertion be made for the employer to have the ability to transfer employees without the consent of the employee if it's operationally justified and after due consideration of the representation, subject to all the other criteria that's already in the law itself. On the next slide, please. In terms of secondments, this is a minor amendment. Currently, Section 6 of the PAMA allows for the secondment of employees across spheres of government. What we are proposing is that secondment should only take place if it's operationally justified. So once again, we're limiting the abuse on the secondment of employees, and we are saying it must be operationally justified. In terms of Clause 4, which deals with Section 7 of PAMA, which talks to the transfer of employees when functions are transferred. If you look specifically at Section 7 of PAMA, it deals with what happens or processes that must be embarked on when legislation is transferred when functions are transferred across the spheres of government or within the spheres of government. What we are proposing is a repeal of Section 7 because these function transfers are already regulated in the Public Service Act, the Municipal Systems Act, as well as the Constitution. Next slide, please. In terms of Clause 5, which is conducting business with the state, Section 8 of PALMA currently provides that no employee shall do business with the state and no employee shall be a director of a company which does business with the state. And it provides for what happens if you contravene the provisions, and the contravention is a criminal matter as well as a disciplinary matter. So that's currently PALMA. The challenge we've had with the implementation of Section 8 is that there is no definition of what is construed as a director of a company. So we've clarified that. And the definition we've included is the one that's found in the Companies Act. So we've aligned it. And you'll see the companies that are mentioned there. We've also clarified that when employees are appointed ex officio on boards, they are not construed within the scope of the prohibition in terms of Section 88. What this means is that in terms of current legislation on various state-owned entities, there are requirements that ministers put representatives on those boards, and they become ex officio. So they're representative because they are employed in government. So the idea with Section 8 was not to prohibit those employees from being on boards and for those institutions from conducting business with the state, because a lot of those institutions do conduct business with the state. So the idea of ex officio employees was not envisaged to fall within the scope of that prohibition. So what we have done is we've created a provision that excludes members of boards that are acting in their official capacity on those boards. The way that, or the effect of that will be to allow that particular employee who is acting in that official capacity will remain an employee or responsible for reporting to the employer who places them in that board. So they will still have those employee obligations or those obligations to the people they represent. They will also have, as members of those boards, fiduciary duties under the Companies Act. So we think those particular people will be properly provided for as we move through the implementation. There should not be a negative impact in excluding them. The third amendment we are doing with Clause 5 is that we are allowing for the Minister for Public Service and Administration to determine that certain transactions between the state and the employee are not construed within the definition of conducting business with the state. And that simply is to remove any unintended consequences that arise from this particular implementation. An example would be those employees who are employed as educators, and they are then employed to do marking of exam papers. That particular transaction we want to exclude from this. We don't want to be criminally prosecuting teachers for marking exam papers. So it's the simple, it's not an endless list, but it is a list. There are a few activities that should not be construed, as it would then undermine the working of government if we had to implement it that way. On the next slide, please. I'm going to deal with Section 6 or Clause 6, 7, 8, and 9 holistically. These are provisions that deal with education and training of employees, as well as the National School of Government that will provide that education and training. We have revised Sections 10, 11, 12, and 13. to the extent that currently under Palmer, the National School of Government is expected to be created as an institution of higher education. We are proposing that that mechanism is not feasible, both financially, as well as when you look at what is the outcomes you want to achieve as the state. The National School of Government needs to be configured as an education and training institution that is providing education and training that is specifically needed for employees within the public administration. It is not envisaged to become another higher education institution where you get qualifications that are generic. The intention of the National School of Government is to ensure that employees are able to receive the training and the education that they require to perform their duties within the organization. So you're looking at specifically ethics training, supply chain management training, financial management training for managers, training that is not usually done at a higher education institution level. So therefore, the amendments are proposed that we retain the National School of Government as it is currently configured as a national department. We allow the National School of Government, or we empower the National School of Government, to provide education and training to all employees in all spheres of government, including municipalities. We provide for the minister to determine categories of employees that must be trained, mandatory training, and we provide for the NSG to provide those services, as well as to ensure that departments must make available within its budget finances that will allow this training to take place. Section 12 is being repealed because it is no longer necessary. Most of the provisions have been incorporated in the revised Section 11. We have also taken away the obligation or the burden on cabinet to administer or to deal with administrative matters that arise from training. Currently under Section 13.1, the requirement is that when the minister determines mandatory training, it must do so after concurrence with cabinet. We have removed, or we are proposing the removal of the requirement to take these matters to cabinet, as we believe that it should be dealt with administratively. The next slide, please. In terms of Clause 10, which is your minimum norms and standards, Section 16 of PALMA provides a whole list of minimum norms and standards that the minister must or may issue on. And the way that that usually gets issued is through regulations, and those are the provisions of PALMA. It must be through regulations, which must be done in consultation with the Minister of COCTA, Minister of Treasury, as well as SAGA. What we are proposing as an amendment to Clause 10, which is the areas of norms and standards that may be considered for regulation, is a requirement under Section 16.2, which requires the minister to consult all EAs, which is all municipal councils, to issue regulations in terms of the values and principles contemplated in Section 195. It is an impractical solution or an impractical process to embark on to issue regulations in terms of Section 16.1A, and therefore we are proposing that for all the issuing of all norms and standards, the same process should follow in terms of the making of regulations, and that a separate process, which is 16.2, should not be required. And we are therefore suggesting a repeal of Section 16.2, which provides for a different process of regulating norms and standards. In terms of Clause 11, which is your Office of Standards and Compliance, currently, the PALMA in Section 17 provides for a Office of Standards, and it provides that the Office of Standards has particular functions within the section. In section 17.7, there's a requirement that the minister responsible for public service and administration must describe the powers of the office and its members. We are proposing the removal of the words "and its members" because there is no members in the act, in the configuration of the office. So it's not a properly defined term, nor do members individually have powers under the act. It's the office which has powers, which has responsibilities, and for which powers must be then regulated and prescribed. So we are taking away the words "and its members." The next slide, please. Clause 12 is one of the most important provisions of the Single Public Service Initiative, as well as the Palmer Amendment. Section 17A and 17B seek to create an enabling environment where there is coordination amongst the various sectors of government. For purposes of Section 17A and 17B, we have expanded the scope of the bill to include public entities. So these two sections will include and will apply to national government, provincial government, local government, as well as public entities. What we are providing in Section 17A is the power for the minister to prescribe factors that must be taken into account when institutions in the public administration determine remuneration and conditions of service for employees in the public administration. So what we are saying is that we are not undermining any current processes or procedures or laws or any other obligations under any other prescript that requires the determination of remuneration and conditions of service of employees. What we are doing is that we are prescribing certain factors that must, as a matter of course, be taken into account. So your economic climate, your fiscal constraints, those kind of things will be the kind of things we would want employers in the different spaces to consider when making those determinations. Section 17B is another step towards ensuring that there's coordination across government. The way that we are proposing that coordination take place is that we are saying, in the event that there is a determination that affects remuneration and conditions of service of employees across the public administration, including public entities, for which you need to enter into a collective agreement. Before you enter into that collective agreement, you must get the concurrence of a committee of ministers, which we have established through Section 17B, that includes all the relevant ministers. The reason for that is not, again, to undermine existing processes. It is merely a mechanism to ensure that there is proper coordination. Because if you are talking about one fiscal framework for the country, it must apply across the administration. It must take away the disparities that exist in the determination of these remuneration and conditions of service. Next slide, please. In terms of Clause 3, which is still on PAMA, we are amending the provisions of Section 18. Currently, as I said, to make regulations under PAMA, you need the concurrence of the Minister of Finance, the Minister of COCTA, as well as SALGA. We are providing that the process to make regulations that affect municipalities should be similar to the process that's undertaken through the Municipal Systems Act, and therefore we are suggesting that the amendment be after consultation with organized local government as opposed to in consultation with local government. So we are recognizing the role of SALGA, but we are saying that we should consult them, but not necessarily reach consensus with them. In terms of clause 14, we are creating a mechanism to manage conflicts that may arise with other legislation, to the extent that we say PAMA will prevail if there is such a conflict. There are particular conflicts that may arise in the making of norms and standards, and therefore we are proposing that this conflict provision be introduced so that there is certainty on who does what in the space. The next slide, please. The next bill, Madam Chair and committee members, is the Public Service Amendment Bill. The next slide, please. Again, the context to start with is that we have last amended this bill in 2007, or this act in 2007. We introduced a new dispensation then. We issued regulations in around 2016. We have since implemented the Amendment Act, and we have looked at areas and identified gaps and done an analysis, taking into account the public reforms that are necessitated by the National Development Plan, other policy imperatives, court decisions that we've had on various matters that require an amendment to the law, as well as the recommendation on a technical amendment that needs to be done that comes from the South African Law Report Commission, Law Commission's report. And we have thus proposed the following amendments to the Public Service Act. Next slide, please. The first clause deals with definitions again. We have once again amended the definitions for ease of interpretation. I think it's important to note in the amendment of the definition of executive authority, we sought to clarify the powers of the president and the premier in respect of HODs. This has been a debate in many of our courts. We currently have conflicting judgments in the courts, and we are clarifying it through the legislation amendments. Clause 2, we are dealing with the powers of executive authorities. Currently under the Public Service Act, Section 3 regulates the powers of an executive authority. Executive authority for purposes of the committee is the president in respect of the presidency, ministers, the commission, the chairperson of the commission in respect of the commission, premiers in respect of the office of the premier, and MECs in provincial departments. So Section 7 currently provides for extensive powers, including administrative powers, to be located with an executive authority. We have, through Clause 2 and the later clause, amended these provisions to decentralize administrative powers to HODs and to locate strategic and policy powers with executive authorities. We have also recognized the responsibility that executive authorities have in terms of the Constitution, and we have put in place checks and balances to ensure that those constitutional imperatives are not undermined through the relocation of administrative powers. On the next slide, please. In terms of Clause 4, and this now talks to the powers of the HOD, taking into account the devolution of administrative powers from the executive authority to a head of department. This approach is taken to unburden the executive authority from dealing with your routine administrative matters. It's also taken into account that we want decision making to be expedient and efficient, and it becomes so if decision makers are closer to the administration. Accountability is also enhanced if both administrative and financial responsibilities are located in one place. Once you do that, you have HODs and accounting officers who are better able to align budgeting processes to human resource matters. The conflicts and tensions that sometimes arise between the executive authority and the head of department is less likely to impact on the administration of the department. This also assists to address the political administrative interface that the NDP talks to. Executive authorities, as I said, are able to focus on strategic matters as well as their constitutional obligations. And the head of department is ultimately then accountable for the output and the performance of the administration, because you will have a head of department that is responsible for finances as well as human resources, and therefore must ultimately be able to account. So that has been the process that underpinned the devolution of powers, of administrative powers to HODs. In addition, in respect of the head of the presidency, which is the DG in the presidency, we have additionally placed functions on the DG in the presidency. And this arises from the NDP objective to create an administrative head in the public service, to whom DGs would report on operational, organizational, and administrative matters. This is now being seen as a more strategic role that supports the president to bring the spheres of government together and to allow for a more synergized approach. Part of the functions that are being placed on the DG in the presidency is that the DG in the presidency will now support the president in respect of HODs. The DG in the presidency would play the role of cabinet secretariat. The DG in the presidency would also be responsible for convening FOSAD. And the DG in the presidency will be able to support, or should be able to support, the president in any other matter that the president may need support in. So those are the additional functions we have placed on the DG in the presidency. On the next slide, please. In terms of clause 3 to 13 and clause 16, these are consequential amendments that we've had to make in respect of administrative powers that now reside with HODs. So wherever in the Act there were administrative powers, we have now relocated them to refer to an HOD rather than an EA having those powers. Some of those powers are relating to organizational structures, human resource management, the employment and conditions of service of employees, whether formerly employed or currently employed, the appointment of persons, on probation, transfers, secondments, early retirements, approval to do outside remunerative work, etc. I think the one thing to emphasize in these powers is while HODs have these administrative powers in respect of DDGs and levels below the HOD, all these powers in respect of the HOD reside with the president or the premier. So if it's the appointment of an HOD at the national department, it would be the president who would be responsible for the HOD's appointment as well as the career incidents. If it's in the province, the premier of that province is responsible for the career incidents and appointment of that particular HOD. So all these other powers that are vested with HODs are in respect of employees below the level of HOD. Next slide, please. In terms of clause 9, it's a technical amendment. There's the term officer that's used, but it's not defined. We've replaced it with employee, which is a defined word. In terms of clause 13, again, it's another technical amendment that was picked up by the Law Reform Commission. a reference in section 31.3 is incorrect, and we've corrected the reference. In terms of clause 14, we have amended section 32, which deals with appointments to acting positions, as well as the reassignment of employees. We've rewritten the provisions to ensure that when it comes to a HOD, the powers are vested with the minister responsible for that HOD. So the power to reassign a HOD, as well as the power to appoint an acting HOD, resides with the minister, not the president or the premier. But we have put in a proviso that if there's an acting appointment for a HOD, then it must be done after consultation with the president. In terms of the powers to direct, again, similarly, the power to direct an employee below the level of HOD will be with the HOD, and the power to direct the HOD will be with the relevant minister. Next slide, please. In terms of clause 15, it deals with the grievance processes. Currently under section 35, grievances are managed through processes that are defined and regulated by and determined by the Public Service Commission. So when an employee lodges a grievance in a department, that process has been defined by rules of the Public Service Commission. When the employee lodges a grievance at the Public Service Commission, those processes are similarly regulated by the Commission. The proposal seeks to amend that provision to the extent that when an employee lodges a grievance at a departmental level, that process will now be determined by the Minister for Public Service and Administration and not the Commission. And that's simply to delineate the powers of the Public Service Commission versus the employer. The Commission has voiced an opinion that they believe they are conflicted and it compromises their ability to do their work if they are dealing with internal processing as well. So that amendment is to take and to revert that power back to the department, to the minister. Clause 17 is wrongly granted and the recovery of wrongly granted remuneration. Section 38(2)(b)(1) is a provision that was declared unconstitutional. This provision used to allow HODs to make deductions from employee salaries unilaterally if there was an overpayment in the salary. The Constitutional Court has since ruled that that unilateral deduction is unconstitutional, and it required then an amendment to Section 38. We have proposed an amendment that aligns with the provisions of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, but it also sets in place a process that allows for the deduction against an employee's salary without necessarily reverting to court, but after a particular process has been followed that meets the constitutional requirements. In terms of Clause 18, we've dealt with the delegations, and this is again another technical amendment. It was an interpretation challenge that it was found, and we have since amended it. Section 42A3A allowed the president to delegate powers in respect of the HOD, and the words used there was deputy president as well as minister. But if you look at the definition of minister in the Public Service Act, it talks to the Minister for Public Service and Administration. But if you look at Section 42A3A, the intention was for it to mean a member of cabinet, not necessarily the Minister for Public Service and Administration. So we have replaced the word minister with a member of cabinet. So that would allow the president to delegate HOD powers to the deputy president or a member of cabinet. The next slide, please. I think we are done. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Naidu, for the presentation. Honorable members, here is the presentation. Let's engage if we deem so or make comments. Over to you. I've got Honorable Kibi, Honorable Tuli, Honorable Maluleke. Those are the three hands for now. And Honorable Gondwe and Honorable Koman. I'll do a zebra style. Honorable Tuli, followed by Honorable Gondwe, followed by Honorable Komane and Honorable Kibi, and any other hand that will be tempted to want to speak. Over to you, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, kindly allow me not to show my video. My connectivity is not well. Chair, I would love to firstly to welcome the presentation from the department. It's so informative. There are some clarities that I would love to seek from the department. Hence, this is more like a consultation format of some sort to the portfolio committee. Firstly, Chair, I wanted to check the issue of the approval to have outside remunerations, whether that is not going to weaken the initial work and find people sort of covertically or maybe indirectly prioritizing outside work for those remunerations or financial streams. Secondly, Chair, in the meeting, in terms of transfers with or without consent, I had the presenter saying that won't be done recklessly. And one wonders if that reckless is going to be carried forward, particularly when looking at the rights of the employee, whether this won't may sometimes cause unnecessary animosity between the employer and the organized labor or stroke unions. And on the same breath, what if this allows senior managers victimizing other victimizing a sorry, Chair. Victimizing other staff members. You remember, Chairperson, at some stage we heard of things for favoritism and themes of victimization by senior managers. Now this with or without, what if the employee is not happy
what will happen if the employee is not happy? Because there is that expression of with or without the consent. What if the employee is not happy? What will happen if the employee is not happy? So as the secondment. Now again, I align the secondment with the same process of such transfers, but I'm just checking if this process won't again happen on those conditions as well. Chair and the meeting, in terms of DGs, ministers, of course, with the consultation of the president. Now I'm trying to check here. We've had numerous cases whereby the DG and the minister are not finding each other. They are not in good terms. Whilst the DG was executing his or her work, but the minister was not happy with 1, 2, and 3. Now, I just checking again on this one to say if now the DG is said to be not performing his or his duties properly. In the main, what will be really informing the duties that are really not performed properly? Chair, in terms of the four pillars that is going to be served by the bill. Now I wanted to check particularly in terms of the public, to say the public the public is really do have the right for the public participation that is enshrined in the constitution of the country. Now I wanted to check if this is not going to maybe open some loopholes for the public to hang things wrongly other than following handling things wrongly and under this bill, to say according to such clause in a bill we are supposed to 23, for instance, you finding them now vandalizing something that has been delivered as a service delivery to them because they are not satisfied with 1, 2, 3, instead of following the right channels, maybe of the petitions and so on. I'm just checking on that one. I think, yeah, that is my take. Comrade Chairperson, I'm sorry. Honorable Chairperson, thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Tuli. Honorable Dr. Gondwe, over to you, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Ausmaina. I have a number of questions. Let me start also by appreciating the presentation from the DPFA. The first question relates to clause 2, which pertains to individual transfer. I also had concerns until they indicated that the transfers would be done in consultation with the affected employee, and where operational requirements justified the transfer and where there are reasonable grounds for the transfer to happen. So I wanted to find out whether there were other measures that they were going to put in place to ensure that it is not open to abuse. So where whistleblowers, for example, are transferred by EAs or accounting officers, you know, how will they ensure that this process is rigorous and thorough and precludes any form of abuse by anybody, more especially accounting officers and EAs? And then in relation to the proposed amendment relating to the conducting of business with the state, according to the briefings that we received from the DPSA and the Public Service Commission, there are possibly 400 public service employees that are conducting business with the state. And I wanted to find out whether the proposed amendment really will go a long way towards ensuring that this number comes down to zero. I understand this number has come down to 400 from 1,000, but we need to come to a situation where there are no public service employees conducting business with the state at all, because that is prohibited. And then I wanted to ask about excluding board members that are upon let me put it this way, public service employees that are appointed onto the boards of companies as ex officio board members. And I wanted to find out why, because with my legal background, I know that ordinary board members and ex officio board members have more or less the same rights. And then in the course of the presentation, she explained that this exclusion, they're proposing that this exclusion be put in place because sometimes ministers appoint reps on the boards of SOEs. But I want to find out that where a public service employee is not appointed, for example, on the board of an SOE, and it's a company, and he's appointed in an ex officio capacity, how are we going to prevent that, you know, that member of the public service from conducting business with the state? Because it's either you're conducting business with the state or you're not. For me, it's black or white, you know. The minute we start putting such an exclusion in place, then at least it must be explicit and indicate, you know, the nature of the companies that you would be serving on as a board member in an ex officio capacity. So it should clearly state you know, the nature of the company, because we have a lot of people that are serving as board members in an ex-official capacity, but these companies or these entities that they serve on are not necessarily SOEs, and the appointments are not, are not done by ministers per se. So how are we going to ensure that, public service employees that fall into that category do not conduct business with the state? And then I also wanted to find out around the National School of Government. I understand that you want to elevate it to the status of a government department, but I want to find out whether this will not have budgetary implications for our fiscal. Can we really afford to have another government department? Perhaps you can explain, what exactly this will entail. Because our fiscus is currently under a lot of pressure, and there are considerable budget cuts across all government departments. And I'm worried that we are trying to now have another government department. Maybe I'm not considering what you're saying properly. And then with regards to Clause 14 on conflict provisions, this amendment preempts that conflicts will arise between PAMA and other pieces of legislation. And I remember the last time you appeared before the committee, I asked this question. I asked what other pieces of legislation, you know, will be in conflict with PAMA, you know. Can you please be specific and cite what those pieces of legislation will be? Because the inclusion of this, you know, proposed amendment preempts that there will be a conflict between PAMA and other pieces of legislation. And now coming to the Public Service Amendment Bill, the proposed amendment, Clause 4 on the powers of HODs. While I welcome that the devolution of administrative powers to HODs and DGs is important, I remain concerned about the appointment of HODs and DGs. So my question then becomes, what mechanisms will be put in place to ensure that the appointment of HODs and DGs is purely based on merit? And what mechanisms will be put in place to ensure that not only competent persons are appointed as HODs and DGs, but the process to appoint these persons is as transparent as possible? And then with regard to the proposed amendment on Clause 14 relating to acting appointments and the reassignment of employees, is it possible for the proposed amendment to stipulate the acting period for public service employees in this regard, in the same manner that the public service regulations stipulate an acting period for public service employees? And then my last question is in relation to the bill that is proposed by Honorable Schreiber. Was this bill taken into consideration at all? I just want clarity on this, because the last time we met, we were given the impression that it will be considered. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Gondwe. That all brings us to Honorable Komane. Over to you, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good afternoon, members and members of the department. Can I not switch on my video, Chairperson, in the interest of my network? Let us also join the queue in welcoming the presentation. However, one has got few questions to the presentation as it is. The first question that raises the serious concern is that in terms of the transfer of employees, one would then take as to guard against the victimization. One would then ask what would be the methods that would be used maybe to safeguard and to make sure that the junior staff members are not victimized by the senior members. Maybe if one may put it like just like Honorable Gondo has just put it, maybe you would find that the senior member would want to transfer a junior member for due to victimization in the interest, in their own interest, for the sake of their own interest. So one would just need to know what measures would then be used to safeguard those. Further to that, one would also ask that, will there be no overstaffing to the department that the staff members are being allocated to? And then and the other question on that item, the last one, would then be, what will then happen to the employees without skills? Because not every employee in a department has got skills. We have got employees that doesn't have skills. So what will then happen to those that does not have skills? And to the appointment of public servants as ex officios on board, okay, one will then ask if whether these members will not have a direct influence on the officials, particularly in the supply chain management. Because we have got a lot of corruption happening, so we just need to know whether this would not be landing in the same situation, where the same would then use their same relatives or their same the same people who are closer to them to benefit from the supply chain management. And in terms of availing the proposal on availing budget for the training, then one would ask, because we have been seeing so many movements, what would then happen if the department does not have the budget for training? Because what you are requiring that the budget should be availed. So what would then say the department responsible would have the budget? Because we've seen it several times, by departments did not have budgets. the next question, Chairperson, would then be in terms of regulations, particularly to Clause 13. One would then ask that does this mean that the minister has to consult SAGA, or is it the organized labor, or is it both for the regulations to be implemented? Because the proposal from the department there is not very clear. And Chair, and on the approval of outside remuneration work, are we not allowing danger of allowing abuse of responsibility here, particularly by officials, and that will ultimately affect the service delivery? Because when we hand over power to the officials, it's kind of risky. So maybe one may pause there, and if there's another turn, we'll come back. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Koman. I'm sure DG, you are also now in a better space, but let me allow Honorable Maluleke. Over to you, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good evening, Honorable Members. Chairperson, some of the questions that I wanted to raise has been raised by my colleagues, but I just want to emphasize on the question that has been raised now by Honorable Komani. She was talking about the availability of budget, and she was saying, what if the department doesn't have that budget? But I just want to say, what if the department has been allocated the budget for training, but then they don't utilize that budget, and just to upskill those employees who are in that department, and maybe in a way they are using that thing of not upskilling those employees for them to be transferred somewhere. Is there any mechanism in place to ensure that departments utilize the available compulsory training budget to the maximum, so that we can have professionalized employees or service public servants in our government? And what is it that the department, PSC, is going to do to ensure that department, they utilize those budgets? Chairperson, I think some of the questions, they've been raised by my colleagues, and I'm happy. I will just pause on this one. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Member. That will bring us to Honorable Sibisi. Over to you, sir.
Greetings to Honorable Chair and the members at large. I must also wish to join the queue by welcoming the proposed amendment bill. Although most of the question has been asked by the Honorable Members, but I wish to go back to the transfer without employees' consent. I mean, in most cases in a workplace, you will find that there are those employees where an employer is not, I mean, they are not in good standing, or is not under, or he or she is not favored by the senior. Now, how are they going to safeguard that this cannot be used as a vindictiveness and to that employee, because this is going to happen. I mean, when you transfer someone without his or her consent, is it not going to cause a lot of problems for the department? And this will also result that we'll end up having more hearings. So how are they going to make sure that this situation will not end up where we have to sit for hearings and everything? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Svisi. That will bring us to Honorable Kibi. Over to you, ma'am.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Let me also join the Honorable Members in welcoming the presentation and also appreciating it. Honorable Chair, most of my questions have already been asked by my colleagues, so I only have one to say. When removing unjustifiable disparities across government, which including public entities, which sector will have to adjust up or down between the public service and public entities, given the challenge of the wage bill, the high salary structure at public entities, and long-term effects of COVID-19 on state budget? That is my only question. I thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Kivi. I'm not too sure whether I was right. I noticed Honorable Motsipe's hand and then it disappeared.
No, I'm still up. Chairperson. Thank you.
Over to you, ma'am.
Okay, ma'am. Yeah, I also like to welcome the presentation and the presenters who presented this bill today. I've got few questions here. The first one is, who will be responsible to reorganizing the organogram of all the workplaces to which mobility of staff will be affected? Where deficiencies exist or where resources and skills are required? Will certain workplaces not to be overstaffed? What will happen to the employees who have not skill for the place to which a required skill is transferred? And then the other question is, what will happen in cases where departments do not provide or use training budgets to upskill certain employees, which may lead to them being redundant at a particular workplace, to warrant transferring them to where it would be undesirable for them? And then, if you are refusing to be transferred, there will be consequences of what will happen. The other question, are you also considering the distance where the employee will be transferred to? The other one, transfers will be also going to include province to another province. The last one, there will be no application to, if you want to be transferred, you don't apply. They will just take you where they will transfer you to, or what will happen? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Members. It's Honorable Sibis.
It's still a call, Chair.
Oh,
I'm so sorry. I have a challenge with the technology. I've been trying to raise my hand, but it couldn't.
Okay.
Just one thing.
Over to you, sir.
Yes, thanks, Chair. Just one thing I had in mind, and allow me to make an example, Chair. In my province, we've seen people moving the employees moving from Ulundi to relocate to Pietermaritzburg as the offices of administration and everything. The question that arose out of it was the lodging spaces, houses for them to live. One question to say, if this is implemented, Chair, does the department or does government have enough living or places to stay where the employees might be transferred to? Just imagine, I'm from Northern KZN, and I'm transferred, say, to a Newcastle. I'm making an example. This is my base. I have everything in here in Eastern KZN, so to say. Whose expenses will be carrying me from my own residence up to that western part of the province? This chairperson, I think, might have some challenges. Not unless the department of government does have a lot of flats all over the country to sort of cater for relocated transferred employees, because these days we talk of the rights for employees. Just imagine myself leaving my family here, going up to Newcastle. I'm away from my wife and kids. I should be maybe having them, as we've seen with other races, where when they move their families. And I think it's now a right for us, or it's no longer a privilege for a chosen few. What is the position of the state when it implements this? Do they have that in mind, that there will be necessity for providing employees with places to stay in when they are transferred, Chairperson? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ndabezitha and honorable members. Probably for my side, it will be a comment, and most of our questions, DG and Ms. Naidu, are for you to take home as you progress with the bill in engaging stakeholders. But for me, I must comment to say that I am encouraged by the boldness of the department to move towards a single purpose service, as it were. If I can, probably not today, this process, which actually will make sure that public servants, regardless whether they are in the SOEs or they are teachers or nurses or within the departments, they are equally paid for same job, and they are equally treated in terms of benefits and related matters, as it were. Recently, DG, the department has advertised almost 300 senior management posts, which I understand is for almost all government departments that would like the post to be filled, but also the province. Then my question, building up what Honorable Kebekulwe has also asked, is that what does that mean? Noting that in the beginning of this term, sixth term, through the minister, is that we want also to streamline or to review the public structure, public service structure, which would be administration, to ensure that there are no duplications, there are no overlapping, and also we place people where they're supposed to be. And with that advert and the process of amending the legislation, the board bills, what does that mean vis-a-vis the 3 months acting position that will suggest that if it's more than that, would have in made an impression that the person is going to be appointed permanently. But also, it's ever going restructuring, as it were, like making a very abstract example. The Brand SA and tourism, there are talks in the cabinet that they're going to merge, but it seems like it's going to be a very long way to do that. What does that mean in relation to this amendment? Does it then seek to address and synergize and streamline all those processes to make sure that everything is neater and the public servant, as it were, or service, is the one from national, provincial, and local government to make sure that we are able also to attract the scarce skills, as it were? It's just a question that it needs to be looked at, which I think one of the bills must talk to that as well. Thank you very much. Over to you, DG and Ms. Naidu. I'm not too sure whether DG has got has now regained the connectivity. But over to you, ma'am, and both ladies, Naidu and DG.
Chairperson, can I check that you can hear me now?
Loud and clear, ma'am. Thank you very much.
Okay, I had to change my gadget. I was connecting on.
Thank you, Chairperson. We have a number of questions that we will share between myself and Ms. Naidu. I will give an attempt to answer some of the questions, and then I will ask Ms. Naidu to also answer, and I'll throw some of the questions that are difficult to Ms. Naidu as I'm answering others. I think that there are questions, firstly, that relates to transfers. And how if you allow me, Chair, I'll just give a response to these questions in a much more consolidated manner. And if members feel that there's something that might have been left out, then they can raise that. I think what we want to clarify in relation to this amendment is that employee-initiated transfers, the provision ensures that the employee rights are protected to limit potential abuse, and these are some of the things that have to happen. Employees will be afforded the opportunity to make representations. The transfer must be linked to operational requirements, not the public interest. So we're focusing on operational requirements. For instance, some of the operational requirements might be that the structure of the organization or the department has changed because of a number of reasons. It could be that as part of the review that we are doing of structures as DPSA, working with the specific department, some of the structures are overstated. So we're advising departments to readjust their structures. We have also done the same thing as DPSA to readjust our structure. For instance, where in the past we've had a chief directorate for communications, when minister approved our reorganized structure, he dropped that position to a chief director, from a chief director to a director position. So we have to transfer people who have been, you know, if there's people, somebody who has been a chief director in that position, that person must be transferred to another role. If there is somebody who was supporting the chief director in that department, that person must be transferred in another role. So the role could be internally, the transfer could be internally within the department, or through the PAMA Act, we're saying such transfers, we must also be able to transfer people from national government to local government without any hassles, or local government should be able to transfer to national government without any hassles, as an example. Currently, the prevailing prescripts do not make it easy for us to do that. The third issue is that there must be reasonable grounds for the transfer, and they must exist in terms of Section 5.2a, and employees must be suitably qualified as contemplated in the Employment Equity Act for the intended position. The employee shall have continuity of service and shall not suffer any reduction in remuneration and conditions of service unless the employee consents, which is Section 5.3 of the Act. The operational requirements means requirements connected with the way an organization functions. Public interest is wider. Usually operational requirements come into play where organizations restructure and reorganize, or where functions are transferred. Employees are used effectively and efficiently and are not employed without rendering a service. Now, like if you think about NMOC now, Chair, we have... The last time I checked, I'll check the report, we had quite a number of SMS members who could not be placed anywhere in other departments, but who are additional, who are in excess in their departments. For instance, the Department of Minerals and Energy had quite a number of people who used to work in minister's office as SMS members, and now they are excess in the establishment. And they don't have positions in the department to accommodate them in the new structure of the department, because two departments were collapsed together as part of NMOC. So these are these type of people that we should be able, due to operational reasons, transfer them to other responsibilities, because now they are in the department, they are not meaningfully engaged. And I think you have some cases as well with a department like DCDT, where there was Department of Communications and other departments that mesh together. So you'll have, for instance, in corporate services, two people who are responsible for risk management at director or chief director level, two CFOs, two people in responsible for internal audit, because two departments were put together. You only need one person for that role in the one new department. So the others, we have to find placement for them, and they are displaced because of operational reasons. We should be able to use this particular clause to deal with those particular matters, and we should be able to move the people from national to local government, as well as local government to national. The Public Service Act currently provides for us to move people between national and provincial government, so it's not a problem. But the movement between national and local government is still an issue that we are addressing through the single public any employee aggrieved by a transfer will be able to the dispute resolution processes, and as a last resort, the courts. So I think I would like just to answer that broadly. But if Renisha wants to add any further questions, she should be able to answer that particular question. Then there was an issue in respect to approval of remuneration outside. Will this not undo the initial work that we have done in this aspect in terms of people prioritizing doing outside work? I think our response here is that the issue around doing work outside, remunerated work outside the public service, that must be approved. And there are processes internally in departments to look at the applications and to look at what time would the person require. And a majority of the things that people want to do as narration that we have seen in terms of our analysis is these things of the stuff that they are selling, like your I don't know what they're called, the marketing things, like your Forever Living, your Hyper Life, and these things that they're selling. And they would indicate that they sell mainly during their after hours and during their weekends. But there is a process already defined in departments in relation to that particular issue. There was also a question around devolution of decision-making on operational matters. I think what we want to say about this issue of devolution of decision-making is that what we are interested in as the DPSA is that is the devolution of administrative powers from the executive authority to the head of department through legislation. Because if you leave to the executive authority, they delegate as and when they wish, and the stability of department get affected, and then a confusion is created in the department at times, or when the minister or the executive authority is not in agreement with the HOD on anything, they withdraw delegations, and this throws a spin in a department when delegations are withdrawn. It's also to ensure that there's alignment with the financial responsibility with human resources administrative functions, which will enable an executive authority to focus on providing strategic and policy direction, whilst the head of department shall manage administrative powers. This will also assist us to manage the administrative, political administrative interface between the executive authority and the head of department, and should improve accountability and remove current conflicts that exist or that arise. Oversight of the work of HOD still remains the responsibility of the executive authority. So the executive authority is responsible to ensure that there's performance feedback that is given to the HOD during performance reviews, and also the performance assessments of the HODs and evaluation is done. This process starts with the HOD, obviously, for self-assessment. Then it moves to the executive authority, who must concur or give their own scores, and then it must go to a panel which is outside of the department, which consists of other ministers as well as the DG in the presidency. So we think that the executive authority will still have an opportunity to give feedback to the DG, whether the DG is performing or not. So the delegation of responsibilities is in respect to administrative powers, really. Public handling things wrongly. I missed this question, but I hope that Renisha has picked it up and will be able to answer it, but I've missed the gist of the question. Dr. Gondwe, Honorable Dr. Gondwe Gondwe has also raised an issue around individual transfers, and I think I've addressed the issue of individual transfers. I won't go back to it. There was also an issue with public servants conducting business with the state. Will these amendments not take us back? Will they lead us to zero in terms of people doing business with the state? Our response to this issue is really that these amendments are meant to clarify certain issues that we've picked up in terms of interpretation as we implement. It is our wish that we go to zero, but we will reach zero when public servants who are doing business with the state stop doing business with the state. The most important thing now is being able to raise awareness on this matter and to get law enforcement to do something about those who are caught doing business with the state. I think that until we have cases of people that go through the criminal justice system, they will send a strong message to others who are doing business with the state. In terms of officials appointed in boards, the principle really with officials appointed in boards is that in boards of entities specifically is that they can't do business with the state. So they can't receive remuneration from the entities that they are board members in. So typically, for the past few years, I've been a board member at the Filimen Publication Board. And as a senior manager in the public service, I am not allowed to take remuneration. So I'm volunteering when I'm doing that responsibility. And this is an issue that we want to cut across, especially employees in state-owned entities, because they also serve in boards, in lots of boards, and they do receive remuneration from some boards that are in entities. Then it becomes double dipping. And we've also picked up in some instances employees in political offices who may not be defining themselves as public servants, and yet they are, in the sense that they are being remunerated from the same purse that all public servants are being remunerated from. NSG, a government department and budget implications. NSG, honorable member, is already a government department at this stage. They are standalone. They report to the minister. It would require more resources to move them to be an institution of higher education. So that's the point that we are raising. But I think Renisha can give more detail in relation to that. Devolution of powers, what mechanisms you put in place regarding appointment of HODs or transparent processes. The current processes of appointing HODs are viewed as transparent to some extent, in the sense that there's advertising and there's interviews and other things that are taking place. Now, there's been a big discussion around how public can you make the interviews of HODs, and how can you bring different other players. But the appointment of the DG, the responsibilities allocated to the DG in the presidency as head of public administration are also aimed at ensuring that when these appointments, these processes of DGs or heads of departments are unfolding, they also play a critical role. There is also a debate on whether to include independent and technical expertise in the appointments in the panels, but I think Renisha can speak on these particular issues. I don't think they are in the amendments yet, because there's still a lot of work that needs to be done in research in this particular area, but Renisha can also speak on that issue. The bill proposed by Honorable Schreider, yes, we received the information, and we have gone through it, we have analyzed it. A number of issues in that bill are covered in this. There is one issue that we are still doing some policy work, and we will update at the relevant time. This relates to employees, public servants who have who occupy political positions in political parties. We are also observing the debates that are going on in terms of local government and the review of the legislation in local government, because this is an issue as well that has been brought to attention. We are currently just finalizing our policy position on this particular issue, and the revised draft of the draft that we consolidate, taking into account the inputs that we have received from various players, including Honorable Schrader, we will definitely include an issue around participation or participation in leadership of political parties. We're just still working around the formulation and the policy stance in respect to that particular issue currently. Honorable Komane, transfers, I've dealt with transfers. I'm not going to add again. Overstaffing in receiving departments, I've also, in a way, dealt with this issue that a transfer cannot just be done as a transfer to dump the problem in another department. All departments have structures, so when you do a transfer, you do it within the context of a structure. So it shouldn't really result in overstaffing in that context. Employees with no skills, I think that the issue of employees with no skills, it shouldn't rise, because employees are not transferred because they don't have skills. They may be transferred due to operational reasons, not necessarily the issue of skills. And the compulsory training is still, by the way, we are supposed to use a certain portion of our salary bill to allow employees to develop, to train employees, and to provide bursaries for employees. So whether an employee is transferred or not, they qualify to participate in the processes, to apply for a bursary or to request for training, and they have their own PDPs, the personal development plans that they do as part of performance contracting, where they will also highlight their own skills that they require. The supervisor of the employee is also allowed to suggest to the employee what are some of the skills they think they require in order to perform effectively as part of the performance feedback processes. I've dealt with the issue of ex officio members, budget for training, I've dealt with it. Regulation clause 13, consult SALGA, I think that Renisha will speak on that issue. My understanding as well is that we have to consult SALGA. The current set of regulations that we need to issue are delayed because of consultations with SALGA. The last time I checked, they were meant to submit to us in February, and then they asked for some extension, and I believe they have not submitted yet. So we cannot move with the set of regulations that are ready because we are waiting for them, and it's an issue that we are handling with them on the side. And budgets are being monitored on an ongoing basis in departments, whether it relates to an employee who's transferred, or the compensation budget gets monitored and the training budget gets monitored. So, and it's unlikely that a department would use the training budget to do other things, because that's ring-fenced funding for budget for training purposes. Transfers again, Honorable Sibusi, so I think I've dealt with the issue. Is it Honorable Sibusi? Sorry. Last question, there was also Honorable Kibi, a question on salaries. I missed this question. Renisha, I hope you heard it. Then there was another question from Honorable Tabekulu related to the impact, the transfers, and how you deal with the resettlement of employees who are transferred, etc. I'll leave that question to Renisha. Then there's a question around, there's a comment or a question around the 300 senior management posts. What I want to say about this is that departments have structures that get approved. In terms of our OD directive, policy directive, departments must come to DBSA every 5 years to consult on their structures, to MPSA to consult on the structures. We have an OD unit at DBSA that works with, that advises the MPSA in respect to structures. So the vacancies, and there's different attrition levels informed by different issues in departments. Maybe others are promoted, maybe others pass on, maybe others retire or simply decide to exit the public service for whatever reasons. So those positions must be filled because there is work that needs to be done. So we have a vacancy circular that we advertise vacancies every second week in the public service, which is the one that is managed by the DPSA. So all departments submit their positions, and you advertise those positions in the vacancy circular. The specific example that you have given around Brand SAA and tourism, in terms of the current laws, the entities like your Brand SAA are not governed by the Public Service Act. They have their own boards that have put policies in place around a number of things, and they have their own executive authorities. So as DPSA, we didn't really be able to reflect on the matter, but we know that there is a project that is run by DPE around the review of state entities in the public service. It starts with the SOCs as well as those state entities that are Schedule A and Schedule B that are reporting directly to departments. And I can't comment much on that process, Chair, at this stage, because I am not sure what are the developments in that one. It's a presidency project which is implemented through DPE, Department of Public Enterprises. Lastly, the idea around acting positions is that people should not act longer in these positions. In terms of our regulations, we really want each position that's vacant to be filled within a particular process. It must be advertised within 6 months, and it must be filled within 12 months. So that, and ideally, it should be filled within 6 months in any case, so that we don't have people acting longer in positions and thereby developing expectations in terms of that acting roles. But we have seen this department where people have acted forever, and now these things result in grievances when you don't employ. Or even, I think we had a case in Gauteng where a person who has acted for a number of years in a director position in the Premier's office was even refusing to contest to apply for the job, saying, but I've been doing the job, why should I apply for the job? So we try and advise departments to guard against making people to act for long, which is why it's important to quickly advertise positions and bring in people to do their work on a full-time basis or permanent basis. And also not to displace other, because an acting, when you take a person from their role to act, it sort of upsets the whole structure, in the sense that at times the one person who's acting in a higher role cannot do the higher role and their role. So you have to get somebody else to act on their role and another one to act on another role. So it creates a level of instability, and acting people generally are not the best people in terms of decision making, taking decisions on time, and having the confidence to take decisions because they are holding the position for somebody else at that particular stage. Chairperson, with your permission, I would like to hand over to Chief Director for Legal, Renisha, to take care of the questions that I've delegated to her, and any other questions she may want to address, even if I've addressed them. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, DG. Before she takes over, let me acknowledge that we have joined by the Minister and the DM. You are most welcome, Makingwane and DM Chikunga. Probably I will allow Ms. Knight to come in, then I will also then come back to you, Honorable Minister, for an overall remarks if you deem to do so. Thank you very much for, and we did note and accepted your apology. Over. Thank you, Ms. Knight.
Thank you, Chair. I hope I'm audible. Thanks, DG. DG's answered most of the questions. Perhaps I want to start first with the principles that we started with. The intentions of the principles is not to regulate the conduct of citizens. It is to set the baseline to understand what is the expectation of the public service as we draft these bills. Because if you look at section 196 of the Constitution and 197, it requires that we have legislation that governs the public administration and the public service. And part of those
requirements in terms of the law is to ensure that the public service is efficient and effective in delivering services. And we take those principles a step further, and we say that in articulating our public service and what we envisage as a public service, we must put in place mechanisms within the public service to ensure that the public service can deliver on its mandate. So it's one component of a bigger picture. So as we draft these bills, we take into cognizance of what is it that the citizen expects of us to do, and what is it we can do in terms of laws to make sure that those kind of services that are expected are actually delivered. So the mandate of the legislation is to place those service delivery obligations on public servants and the public administration entirely. So it shouldn't be construed that citizens can vandalize properties and et cetera if they don't receive those services. The intention is to ensure that we have good governance. The second question in terms of identifying the legislation that sits in conflict with the PAMA, we've identified a few provisions within the Public Service Act versus the Public Administration Management Act. Those are around financial disclosures, your ethics and integrity provisions, your corruption provisions, where there's a dual mandate in both these pieces of legislation. So our intention was to deal with it through a conflict clause, but as we progress through the consultation, there might be other mechanisms that might appear to be better placed to deal with the conflicts, and we will consider that as we get those inputs. But for now, the ones we've identified is particularly in the Public Service Act. In terms of the process to make regulations, currently under the PAMA, the process to make regulations by the Minister for Public Service and Administration is to get the concurrence of the Minister of Finance, the Minister of COPTA, as well as SALGA. That is the current process. So the way the Act is written, it says the regulations will be made in consultation with the Minister of Finance, Minister of COPTA, as well as SALGA. What we are proposing is that we align with the Municipal Systems Act, which says that regulations should be made in consultation with the Minister of Finance, we've included, the Minister of COPTA, and after consultation with SALGA. So it's an alignment that doesn't require then the concurrence of SALGA. It leaves regulations to the executive to manage, which is easier to implement legislation if it's done in that manner. So that's the effect of the proposal. In terms of the issue around ex officio, Madam Chair, I just want to perhaps suggest that we look into this matter. Our understanding of ex officio has been that insofar as it relates to an employee acting as in his capacity as an employee or her capacity as an employee to represent on a board. And the way the act or the provision is written into the law, it specifically talks at in the amendment bill under section 8, which is clause 5, it talks to that the director does not apply to an employee appointed ex officio as a director. So our focus is not on other persons that are appointed, or the exclusion is not about other persons that are appointed as directors, but employees who are appointed as directors because of the position they hold as employees. So the ex officio is limited to employees, but we will definitely look at the comment. I think it's raised some questions. We'll consider those. In terms of how do we ensure that departments use their budget to deal with training, we've also inserted a provision in PAMA specifically, which requires that departments must make appropriate provision in its budget for the compulsory training that is determined by the Minister for Public Service and Administration. So we've built into the Act itself that there must be provision made within the budget to ensure that compulsory training takes place. In terms of the unjustifiable disparities, whether we are moving salaries up or moving salaries down, the intention is not to align salaries completely. It's to remove, because we recognize that in different organizations, different spheres of government, we are all different. The requirements are different, the job descriptions are different, and there's differences in the type of services you get out of those particular posts. So we all have, all the different spheres have different roles to play, and there are differences in that, and we recognize that difference. But as we move forward, the idea is to focus our attention to disparities where there's no justification for that disparity. So if I'm a legal advisor in the DPSA and I'm a legal advisor at a municipality and I'm doing the exact function, there should be no need for the disparity. So the idea is to remove disparities, and particularly around remuneration, conditions of service. We have leave dispensations that are exhaustive in terms of the number of days across the public service and across the administration. They vary, and there's no reason for the differences, but they do. So the idea is we recognize the differences, but it's only the unjustifiable disparities that we want to, over time, take away. And we've put in place processes that will manage that movement away towards creating more synergized public administration. So the idea is not to drop salaries or increase salaries as we move forward. It's to start to find alignment as we move into the future. In terms of who determines organizational structures, currently legislation, the Public Service Act, provides for EAs to determine structures. We're proposing that that now is relocated with HODs. The Municipal Systems Act similarly provides for EAs to determine structures. So that's how structures get determined, and then transfers then become a matter that follows usually an organizational restructuring. In terms of, and this is probably the one question on transfers that the DG has left, is the issue around the rights of employees in respect of relocation to different areas or relocation of their families and the impact on their family life. These are issues that must be dealt with when you consider the representations by an employee. These are the kind of things that will become part of the representations that will be made to a transferring authority. And those are the matters that the transferring authority must then consider. Because if the transferring authority doesn't consider them and doesn't give credence to them, then the decision becomes questionable. The decision becomes irrational, which then opens the door for the employee to dispute the transfer. So it's built into a system. There's not a right or a wrong answer, but it's a process that must take into account the impact that any transfer that is employer initiated will have on an employee. And that must then lend itself to whether or not the decision is to transfer or not to transfer. And with that, I will end my responses. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Naidu. Honorable Matlumane, I'm not too sure, is there anything left for you, but would like to hear your voice, and you are most welcome in DM. I was told that Honorable Minister is here.
Yeah.
Yes, oh, there you are.
Yes. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee. Let me apologize on behalf of myself and on behalf of the Deputy Minister who held up, and we did send an apology. It was unforeseen that the meeting with Labour would be drawn this long. We trust that DG and team have made an elaborate and comprehensive presentation, and that they did explain where we come from and where we are and where we're going with the amendment bills. All we want to emphasize is that in the effort of ensuring that we improve public service, there are quite a number of urgent processes and initiatives that we need members of the Portfolio Committee for in terms of processing, because from where we sit, we lag behind in terms of putting public service in South Africa where it should be, where it would have been by now had it not been for phases in the last few years where it has been affected by interruptions in the process, which found aspects of public service not strong enough to resist whatever interruption that came in the environment in which public service operates in the country. And therefore, we've got to make these reforms, these initiatives, with that in mind, that we're covering space, that we need to move fast, because at the end of the day, public service must be the facilitator or catalyst for delivery to the people of South Africa. That is what it is all about. There's no public service for the sake of public service. Anything that hinders its efficient performance and ultimate delivery of services to the people must be dealt with agency. And therefore, we trust that when the process gets to Parliament, we will be able to move with the necessary speed. We anticipate that cooperation from your side, and that we share the desire with yourselves to get going as soon as possible and to complete the processes. The last issue is on the amendments. Yes, there will be contested areas. One contest will arise with Labour in relation to transfers and other related matters. But another one will arise surely with the executive in terms of where exactly do we draw the line between the EA's executive authorities and accounting officers. But the principle of it is agreeable to everybody, that we do need to draw the line so that whatever happens, whatever wrong happens, it must be given or directed where it belongs correctly, so that there's no hiding behind one another. If the EA makes an attempt to instruct or to give unlawful and corrupt directive, the accounting officer must know that should they agree, they will be held accountable, and there will be consequences of such wrongdoing. There won't be any hiding behind instruction from the EA, because things will be clearer and so on. That's our aspiration. Other than that, I really don't want to delay you, Honorable Members and Chair. I think I'll hold on at that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Matungwani. I noticed that Honorable Komani, your hand is up. I'm not too sure whether it's an old hand or it's a little bit new hand. Can you confirm or deny?
It's a new hand, Chair.
It's a follow-up. Okay. Is there any other follow-up hand? Then I will take it as the follow-up last hand. Over to you, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Chair. I just want to go back to the questions that I raised, and I just want to record that it can never be that the department says when we ask questions, those questions should not arise, because those are clarity-seeking questions, and we as the portfolio committee, we've got all the rights to ask whatever and whichever question that we seek clarity and answers on. It can never be that the department says that the question from a member of the portfolio committee may never should not have arisen. But be it as it may, Chair. On when I asked the question on the transfer of employees, particularly on unskilled employees, I was referring to the organogram that the departments are having had the response from the department when they said there is an organogram, and they said you would find that there is a department which was maybe merged or so on and so on. So it was purely a question that wanted a clarity to say that we have got unskilled public servants within the department, and there would be a need for transfers. What would then happen to them? It shouldn't be, our response should not be that the question shouldn't have arisen. Anyway, Chair, the other follow-up that I wanted to make was on the approval of the outside remuneration work. On my question, I said, Chair, we would check whether when we approve the remuneration from the outside remuneration, whether that would not impair the service delivery. Because that is a practical thing, that is what we have been experiencing, particularly from municipalities and other spheres of government, where public servants tend to leave their work during working hours and do their external things, or vis-a-vis closes those offices and do their outside remuneration work at the expense of the taxpayers' money, at the expense of the service delivery. And that was not answered to. Maybe if you can have clarity on that, but I just want, again, Chair, to put on record that it cannot be that when we ask questions, we answer that those questions shouldn't have arrived. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Minister, I'm sure you were at that time, you wouldn't have joined us. Probably we can take a bite on this one.
No, thank you very much. On remuneration, because I would take it that we all aware that remuneration possibly is divided into by public servants, would be divided into two. There's remuneration that is ordinary permissible as a result of your work during working hours as an employee and so on. But there's then the other one, remuneration that is outside working hours. And there are also two divisions. That one that for which you have to get permission. And I suppose there would be others that are for declaration, but possibly for which you may not need permission for, like NGOs for which you get paid transport or allowance, something like that. Be that as it may be, the Honourable Member talks about people who live work during working hours go elsewhere. That is unlawful, strictly unlawful. And we rely, one, on supervisors, because there is no employee of the state who is without a supervisor from DG. DG is supervised by the minister or by the ministry. And then all DGs are supervised by the DG and then downwards. So should we come across anywhere of somebody who is doing work during working hours, either in the office by abandoning work and then just do their work but within working hours and in the office, or actually leave the workplace, that must be treated as unlawful, and therefore there must be a consequence. On the first question, well, I didn't get the context, but I do see that there may have been a response which is not satisfactory. I think maybe DG could come back because she would aware of the context, so that the answer is responded to properly, so that we all get satisfied. That is what I would propose, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Minister. DG, if you may, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Minister. I think it's really, let me just apologize for the misunderstanding. Okay. I think it's purely a figure of speech that I was using when I say an issue should not even arise, because there's already provisions to deal with that particular matter. So I was not saying the committee or the committee members should not ask the question, but I was just saying from a point of view that there are systems and processes already in place, in particular on this issue, the issue of employees who require reskilling for whatever reasons. And I said, I suggest that when we think about reskilling, we must not think about it only in the context of transfers, but reskilling and retraining of employees as part of commitments that in the public service we have made. And there's resources that are provided for this through a certain portion of the salary bill. I think it's 1% or 1.5% of the salary bill goes into training. So whether an employee is transferred or not, as long as they're an employee of the department, they qualify for reskilling. So I think that I truly did not mean that members must not ask questions, but it's a figure of speech that I was using to showcase that there's already various checkpoints in the system already, and it's a matter that we are not worried about. And I apologize for the use of language, which may have come across to mean something different. Apologies, Chair.
Thank you very much, Minister and DG and Ms. Naidu. Honourable members, that concludes the presentation on the Single Public Service Status Progress. I think we will be eagerly waiting for the bill to be formally tabled before Parliament, but at least the department had an advantage to know the thinking and the questions that the portfolio committee would like to be taken care of, either in the two bills, proposed bills, or in any other form that may be, because some of the issues that were raised were not necessarily within the bills itself. But with that, Minister and your team, thank you very much for respecting us and taking us into confidence as one of your stakeholders. Honourable members, that will bring us towards the end. But before we close the meeting, there's one item, if you may allow me, that I would like to talk to or make an announcement, is to say that we have been receiving numerous, Honourable Minister and DGE and your team, if you feel like leaving the meeting, you are most welcome to leave the meeting. That we have been receiving through the Office of the Chairperson's numerous letters that warrants our attention. One of those letters is the letter that we received from the Speaker's Office, from one of the Public Service Commission, Senior Management, advocate, I wouldn't necessarily remember her surname, but who was complaining about the chairperson in terms of satisfied about the treatment and the speaker. Subsequent to that one, she requested the chairperson of the Public Service Commission, Advocate Suzanne, to respond to the merits of the issues, which he did. And the letter and Advocate Suzanne's letter was referred to us. We requested during my acting period, we requested through the administration that let's get a legal advice. We have received a legal advice, and I would like to suggest that a portfolio committee manco be scheduled not later than next week to look at the matter. If it necessary, it necessitate that it must be brought before the committee to attend to it, let it be. But that manco meeting, parliamentary legal services must be invited to be part of that, and then we can report in terms of the progress of that matter. Secondly, is the one of the members' bill that we have received, which seems to cut across more than one department, which is Treasury or Finance Department, and we have asked DPNE, which is the Monitoring and Evaluation Department, to advise us how to handle the matter. Not to say that how to advise us, whether does it fall within their mandate, because definitely sure it doesn't fall under DPSA. It's closer home to DPME. But also if you look at it, it's closer home to economic development or small business. And we will be in one will be busy. One of the weeks we'll have more than two meetings, so that we can attend to those issues. And the members' bill and also people who have written to us, they should see and feel that we are attending to their issues. So I've requested the administration through Maskole to see, to find a day where we can have two meetings so that we can attend to those issues, because we shouldn't be seen as if we neglect issues that are brought before us. In particular, if the issues have also been written to the office of the speaker. The very last one is that next week we will be meeting twice a day on the looking at the annual reports. We'll meet with DPNE in the morning, and in the later of the day we'll take a lunch break, a 2 hour or 1 hour. And we'll meet with StatsSA so that we are ready for StatsSA tabling of its report before the House. So the program that has been circulated will be slightly adjusted to fit in and comply with the schedule of Parliament that has been circulated through the chairs and also the administration. And I'm sure, Comrade, Honourable Mr. Zubek, of my apology, I've covered the points that I should have notified the meeting. But I would like, on the first item that I've raised pertaining public service, to get a concurrence of the committee to allow us to meet as a manco, so that we can sift the issues when it comes before the committee. We are clear what we are bringing to the committee. Are we in agreement with that suggestion, Honourable Members?
May I hear
you? Yes.
Chair.
I'm not too sure. Okay. It's Honorable Ntuli. Your hand is
yes,
up.
Chairperson. Yes, Chairperson. Yes, Chair. Chair, I wanted to support the idea of the meeting of the Manco first. Yes, Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. There were other voices. Are they in concurrence with the Honorable Tuli's view and support of what I've suggested?
Yes, Honorable Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Members. That will bring us to the end of our meeting. Thank you very much for your attendance and your time, and also to the department. Thank you very much.
looking forward to the new dispensation of a single public service, as it were.
Thank you, and have a
thank
good
you.
Evening.
Good night. Meeting Chairperson. Thank you.
Good night, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair.